On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
This week, there is going to be a milestone report released from the United Nations, due to be released tomorrow morning, warning that a 1.5 degree rise in the Earth's temperature will be reached 10 years earlier than expected. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change findings are expected to be fairly damning and are being described by experts as a wake-up call for governments across the world. It comes as wildfires are raging across Greece and actually threatening the site of ancient Olympia, the site of the original Olympics, particularly pertinent, obviously, at the moment. Now, joining me to discuss this report, what it might mean and where we're going, is David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth and editor-at-large at New York Magazine. David, a very good afternoon to you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You might start first by explaining, what is this kind of this IPCC report? How often does it report and how significant is it likely to be?
So the IPCC is the UN's climate change body, and it's essentially an international network of scientists who are tasked with processing or synthesizing everything that the scientific community has put together over the past number of years into a report that the world's policymakers can look at and trust as a sort of a gold standard, everything's been vetted account of what we know about the state of climate science in the near future. And this body does a number of things, but periodically they put out major reports that are really meant to be sort of global and comprehensive in their scope. Those happen, you know, it used to be every 4 or 5 years, now it's every 7 or 8 years, just because the process takes a bit longer. And they also do interim reports that are more focused. For instance, you might, your listeners might have remembered a couple of years ago the report on the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees of warming. There was also one about oceans about a year ago and one about land. This one that's coming out on Monday is the first installment of the next big comprehensive report. So it's issued in parts. And this one, actually, I think is going to be a little less dramatic and less exciting than the ones that follow, because it is devoted to the scientific basis for the understanding of the Earth's climate. It doesn't deal directly with impacts, with projected impacts. It doesn't deal directly with emissions trajectories. It doesn't deal directly with solutions. So it's sort of a, you know, it's about what the scientists know about the state of the planet today. And there are several eye-opening and very important findings in it. But for people who have been following the state of climate science for a while, I don't think it's likely to dramatically change their view of the state of things. It's an update, and it paves the way for the next reports, which may do more of that.
Okay, for the people who maybe haven't been following it or the casual person listening, you might put this into a bit of context, because one of the headlines we're seeing is that the 1.5 degree Celsius increase in the Earth's temperature from pre-industrial times is likely to be achieved 10 years earlier than thought. The rate at the minute is thought to be 1.2 degrees Celsius hotter now than we were then. So I suppose to the casual person looking, 0.3% of a degree doesn't sound like that much on paper, but what could it actually mean at a practical level, and how significant is it?
Well, to begin with, so at just 1.2, we are already warmer than the planet has ever been in the entire history of human civilization, which means, you know, the climate that gave rise to everything we know of as history, agriculture, politics, you know, modern culture, Hollywood, pop music, geopolitics, all of that is the result of climate conditions that we've already left behind and we're never going to recover. So we're already entirely, it's like we've landed on a new planet with a new set of climate conditions. That's where we are today at 1.2. 1.5 has long been described as the sort of target, the goal, that the ambitious, you know, the hope that we could limit warming to that level. Scientists worry that letting warming continue past that up to 2 degrees would bring what they've often called a catastrophic level of impacts. Island nations of the world have called it genocide, and African climate diplomats at climate conferences have called it death for their continent. So the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees is really, really quite significant. And what it means to be achieving 1.5 earlier than we expected is ultimately that we have a lot less time to decarbonize and stabilize the Earth's planet before we get to 2. You know, if we, the reaching of 1.5, it'll be a worse climate, a harsher climate than we are today at 1.2. But the really dramatic impacts start to kick in north of 1.5, and the ultimate implication is less about that threshold per se, and more just, you know, it's like you're driving down the road and, you know, you get a little alert that says you're going way past the speed limit. That's sort of the meaning of this, that we're moving much faster into the danger zone than we thought that we were. And in fact, in this report, the scientists find that, you know, even the emission scenarios that were designed to give us a guide for how we could stay below 1.5 degrees, even in that emission scenario, they expect that we will breach 1.5 degrees in the timeline that you mentioned. So in the probably the early 2030s, they expect that for complicated reasons we can discuss if you'd like, we would be able to, in that scenario, sort of draw back down our carbon emissions and bring the temperature back down under 1.5 in a few decades, but at least temporarily, even in the emission scenario that was designed to give us a chance to stay below 1.5 degrees, they say we will be crossing that threshold and we will be doing it within about a decade.
So if we are going to be in that situation in the late or early 2030s, it would seem to make this 2050 target that is often hailed of carbon neutrality somewhat obsolete.
Well, it depends what your goal is. I mean, if you're hoping to keep the planet to planet's warming to 1.5 degrees, I think, you know, getting to net zero by 2050 is not enough. And we sort of know that. We knew that before in the sense that all of the emissions trajectories and models that give us 2050 as a net zero target for limiting warming to 1.5 degrees also involved an enormous, you know, planet-changing scale of what's called negative emissions, which is, you know, taking carbon out of the air in varieties of ways, some of them natural, like reforestation, others having more technological tools, like, you know, these direct air capture machines. But, you know, if we were only getting to net zero in 2050, we would have to be deploying a negative emissions industry, according to most of these models, that is at least twice as big and maybe four times as big as today's oil and gas business.
Can I ask you to interrupt and cut across you there, but I did want to ask you about that taking carbon out of the air through artificial means. Like, can that be done and can that be done on scale? Because obviously this idea of reforestation, yeah, it's great if you can get people to do it. Obviously we can't in certain countries like Brazil. But is there a technological solution to taking carbon out of the atmosphere for good?
Well, there is a solution. We have machines today and they work, but they are expensive. They are more expensive. You know, it's more expensive to take carbon out of the atmosphere than it is to avoid putting it there in the first place. And there is a really large problem with scale, as you suggest. So a major report on carbon dioxide removal that came out about a year ago looked at both natural solutions like reforestation and some of these technological solutions, direct air capture and carbon capture and storage. And they found that just for the sliver of emissions that are the hardest to abate, which is to say heavy industry and jet fuel, which is just a tiny percentage of the overall problem, just to mitigate those emissions, doing so with natural solutions like tree planting, which is good for many reasons beyond carbon removal, but just to do it through tree planting would require using land something on the order of 10 times the size of Texas, a large percentage of the Earth's currently available arable land. And doing it through technological approach would require something like a third to half of today's total global energy production. So, you know, we have, in both cases, we have the tools. Like, we know trees absorb carbon. We know we have these machines that can do that work. But as with, you know, decarbonization through expansion of renewable energy, it's not so much a problem. It's not a conceptual problem. It's not a technological problem. It's a problem of politics, you know, society, status quo bias, and exactly how we can transform the world as rapidly as we needed to in all of these ways, which is one reason why I often say, you know, this is not a problem that's going to be solved in any one way. There's not a single silver bullet solution to climate change. We need to rapidly transition our energy systems to renewable energy. We also have to be deploying these negative emissions technologies. We probably also have to be doing a lot of R&D to bring new technologies online. But we can't wait for that development to happen, and we can't count on carbon removal to save us. The problem is just too big to solve in any one way. We have to throw everything at it we can.
We're used to a very mild climate here in Ireland and in the UK as well, and there's been warnings in one of the Irish Times very recently that Ireland could have winters as cold as Toronto in Canada if a potential collapse in the Gulf Stream happens. What kind of change, because we've seen more extreme weather events in other countries that are maybe more used to them. We're not used to them here. Getting beyond the 1.5 or getting into these situations that are being talked about in the German research in relation to the Gulf Stream, what kind of impact would that happen on the likes of Ireland, where the climate up to now has been very mild?
Well, I think, just more extreme weather is the sort of global prediction there. In terms of more local impacts, it's a little hard to say, in part because we don't really know how that would all unfold. You know, the report, I think that paper that you're describing, I think was a little alarmist in its headlining. I think that, you know, the scientists, we believe that this ocean conveyor belt is certainly slowing down. Scientists were suggesting that it's possible that it may be reaching or approaching some tipping points. But even if it passes those tipping points, we're not talking about a light switch stop in that conveyor belt. Probably it would just mean an acceleration of the slowdown that we've already seen, which would produce more of the kinds of extreme weather and unpredictable weather that we're seeing now. That's not to say it's no big deal. It would scramble our expectations, not just, you know, in Ireland, but really all around the world. Some of the most intense impacts would be felt in more mid-latitudes and the tropics. But it's, you know, as with many of these tipping points, when scientists talk about tipping points, they're often talking about things that nevertheless, you know, tipping points sound so sudden and extreme. Mm-hmm. And they're still talking about things that will take probably centuries, if not thousands of years to unfold. And so, you know, I think that the language there is a little more alarming than the science suggests. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it's one of many, many impacts that will be scrambling our expectations for every aspect of life on this planet. I mean, every feature that we've come to depend on and expect as the basis of human life and civilization is being disturbed by the climate perturbances that we're introducing. And those are only going to get more dramatic as we go forward, extreme weather being one of them.
How much of the events that we see, for example, in California, in Greece and Turkey, in terms of wildfires and those very distressing scenes, how much of that is just the new normal of things?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's not just the new normal. It's the beginning of something that's going to get a lot worse. You know, all of these trends are moving quite rapidly. Wildfire is one of the most dramatic changes that we're likely to see over the next few decades. We're already seeing it, as you mentioned, not just in California and in the Mediterranean, but in Siberia, where they've had fires burning all through the Siberian winter, all through the Arctic winter, called zombie fires. They're having massive, massive fires right now, fires that we've seen in Australia over the last couple of years. It really does seem like, you know, much more of the planet is burning than used to be the case a few years ago. And that's especially concerning for two reasons. The first is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when we're talking about climate solutions, trees store carbon. When they burn, it's like burning coal. It releases carbon. So each of these wildfires is adding some significant amount of carbon emissions to the atmosphere. And in fact, a lot of the recent fires in the American West, especially in Oregon, have burned through forests that were planted or replanted as part of carbon offset programs designed to capture carbon. So they're sort of tearing through our ability to respond and mitigate the emissions that we're producing today. In California, it's expected that even without additional warming, just in a sort of a best case, we're going to limit warming to, you know, to something close to the level that we have today. Scientists expect that fires are going to grow about sixfold by mid-century. That's 600% of what they are today. And just in the last few years, we've had record fire season after record fire season. The Mediterranean, as you know, there have always been some fires, but they're burning. They're burning now at much larger scale and in many more places at once than we've really ever seen before. And I think things are going to get, you know, quite dramatically worse. In California in particular, scientists often say they can't project what the fire future is going to be like the second half of the century. But that's only because so much of the state will have burned at that point. They don't know what kind of plant life will come back in the wake of those fires. And they can't model fire without knowing what kind of plants may or may not be burning, which is just a horrifying kind of thing to think about, that as soon as 2050, the entire landscape of that state will have changed so dramatically that scientists studying it can't even model what the future will be like. That's how dramatic those fires will be. And then the second impact of the fires, sorry, I forgot to mention a minute ago, is the air pollution. Last year in the record fire season in the American West, half of all air pollution in the American West was from the burning of forests, which means there was more particulate matter being breathed by Americans living in those states than all other human and industrial activity combined. All the cars, all the factories, all the oil burning, all of that produced less air pollution than the air pollution produced by the fires, which, as I mentioned a minute ago, are going to get considerably worse almost no matter what we do.
Wow. It's quite stark when you put it like that. Finally, David, and somewhat briefly, if you can, because time is a little bit up against us. Reports are all well and good, and this report is going to come out tomorrow. I find it very hard to gauge what the appropriate level of action is, given the amount of greenwashing that obviously goes on with different governments around the world. Now, how far off the pace internationally are we in terms of what we need to be doing, in your estimation?
Well, I think the best estimate is that we're on track for about 3 degrees of warming, which is, you know, a full degree and a half above the 1.5 degree target. But personally, I wouldn't be all that hung up on those particular thresholds. I think they can be useful in focusing our attention. But the truth is, anything we can do to limit warming at any level is useful. Even if we cross 1.5 degrees, even if we cross 2 degrees, it'll still be useful to limit warming to 2.1 as opposed to 2.3, or 2.3 as opposed to 2.7. And so the more we can do, the better. And while there is a lot of greenwashing, as you say, and a lot of these pledges are likely to turn out to be paper pledges unfulfilled, as every pledge ever made on climate as it has been to this point, I still think it's really notable that the countries of the world are finally making those promises. Even if they are empty rhetoric, I'm at least gratified in a weird way to see the rhetoric being put forward. It's a new sign of seriousness. Insufficient, but still notable.
Okay, well, let's hope that some of those are more than paper pledges and actually get done, because it is something that's obviously going to affect us all. Listen, David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth and editor-at-large at New York Magazine, thanks a million for joining us on the show. And that book is very well worth a read. I had a bit of a read of it over the last few days. Very startling in some of its findings, some of the things it talks about, but very well worth it.
On the Record with Gavin Riley. On News Talk